tonight on Arena. Cuifhin O'Rahilla and Thomas Bartlett on Dissolving the Tune, and Paul Lynch and Percival Everett are on the Dublin Literary Award shortlist. Text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. Established in 1994, the Dublin Literary Award celebrates its 30th anniversary this year. Still one of the most lucrative prizes around the world, it's worth €100,000 to the winner of a single work of fiction published in English. The award is sponsored by Dublin City Council and is unique in that the nominations are submitted by librarians and readers from the network around the world. Today, the 2025 shortlist for the award was announced, and we are delighted to see Paul Lynch's Prophet Song among the six authors from around the world, including America, Argentina, Canada and the Netherlands. This year, two of the novels are in translation. The six authors and their works on the shortlist are Not a River by Selva Almada, translated by Annie McDermott, We Are Light by Gerda Blease, translated by Michelle Hutchinson, The Adversary by Michael Crummy, James by Percival Everett, Prophet Song by Paul Lynch, and Northwoods by Daniel Mason. And I'm joined now in studio by Chris Morris, the non-voting chair of the judging panel, to discuss all the novels. You're so welcome. Thanks, as you are every year at this time, Chris. Just remind us again how they're chosen. How are they chosen by the libraries?
Well, I mean, this is one of the things I love about this award, that it's not chosen by, you know, a clique of publishers and critics. It's chosen by librarians and to some extent chosen by readers. So there are networks of libraries around the world who every year nominate books for the Dublin Literary Award. So it's a real map of reading. And it means in some ways, you know, it might take a little bit longer than some of the other literary awards because books have to, you know, get out on the shelves and librarians have to have a sense that they're being read. But, you know, I think it's better.
Yes, and you also get a nice mix. You don't necessarily only the books that were published that year. You get a real sense
That's right.
You know, so yeah. It could be 1 or 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, there's rules around how long it can take. But, I mean, particularly books in translation, you know, by the time a book's translated and it's on the shelf, it can be a little while, which is fine.
So will we get stuck in?
Yeah.
So Northwoods is the first one.
Yeah.
A lot of books here are about settings seem to be really important. There's Northwoods, We Are the Light, Not a River, and Daniel Mason's Northwoods really qualifies as a fantastic setting.
This is a really remarkable book. I mean, usually when you're describing a book, you describe the protagonist. The protagonist in this book is a house and a piece of land. So it starts in the 17th century with a little square of land in the woods in what becomes Massachusetts. And there are two people on the run and they settle. They build a little log cabin. And then it follows, you know, the children of these people, the people who inherit the land. One of the settlers comes along, plants an apple tree. The apple tree grows. The apple tree becomes an orchard. The house gets bits added onto it. And with each subsequent chapter, Daniel Mason does something quite remarkable. He changes the style. So the style of the novel, when you start off, you know, it kind of reads like 17th century prose. And by the end, he comes right up to the present. And then there's a remarkable passage at the end where it kind of projects forward into the future. So it's a sense that people come and go. Politics, history comes and goes, but the land is there.
Yes, because it does tell, let's say, the first couple that you talk about, they're Puritans and they're a couple and they're very much in love and they're running away from their Puritan brethren. So in other words, it's telling the story of America as it goes along.
It is the story of America filtered through this one little patch of land in the Northwoods of Massachusetts.
Okay, so that's Northwoods and that's Daniel Mason. Then We Are Light. It's a first time novelist, Gerda Blease, and it's translated by Michelle Hutchinson. And she found this story in a newspaper.
Mm. It's a remarkable story. It's translated from the Dutch. It's a story of a kind of cult who, by following various gurus on the internet, decide that they can live on light alone.
So they don't eat.
They don't eat.
And the first thing we find out is that somebody in this cult has died of starvation.
As you would expect. So it's the aftermath of that. But she does this really remarkable thing in that each chapter is told from a different point of view. Now, you might say, okay, that's not that remarkable. It's been done before. But you go from the point of view of various characters to the point of view of the crime scene, to the point of view of a butterfly, to the point of view, and this is the one that got me, of the scent of orange.
The scent of orange.
The scent of an orange. So that if you hadn't eaten, the sense of foods would be really strong. So this is what the scent of orange saw. The food processor.
And so are we trying to conjure up, is it kind of whodunit in this fantastically original way to find out how did these people join the cult? And is that what it's aiming
it's
at?
It's more or? Like what would it be like to be inside that world? But also trying to imagine what it would be like, and a bit like North Woods, of trying to get beyond a perspective that's just the human perspective. You know, these are people who have joined this cult to become more than human. So it tries to imagine what is it like to see the world if you are the scent of an orange.
Yes, and that seems to be a way with literature now. I think we were talking to Michelle de Kuster recently, and she was talking about this carrier bag of novels rather than the quest novel where you're following one protagonist through the adventures of their life.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I mean, one of the things that I love about being involved with this award year after year is you think people would run out of new ways of writing novels, and they don't. They just keep coming up with things like this. And it's a very good read as well.
Right. So that's We Are Light by Gerda Blies. And if she wins, she will share the award with Michelle Hutchinson, who is the translator.
That's right. I mean, it's one of the beauties of this award, that €100,000 award, but if it's won by a book and translation, the translator gets €25,000. So when that has happened in the past, as it's happened in the past couple of years, the translators have said to me, this is life-changing. I mean, $25,000 means I can translate what I want for the next year. I don't have to take things on commission. And so it's life-changing.
Yes. And again, now we're moving on to Not a River. And that's a book from Argentina. Can you tell us about that one, Chris? And that again is in translation. And
it
I think people have mentioned how wonderful the translation is here.
I don't read the original Spanish, but my God, it's beautifully written. Yeah, it's poetic. It's one of those novels, you know, it's kind of just barely a novel.
It's tiny then.
It's tiny. Yeah. It's less than 100 pages. But you feel like you've read an epic. It's one of those books you walk away from and you feel like you've read something that was, you know, 600 pages.
So it's three young men go off fishing.
Three young men go off fishing on a river, on an island, and they're camping. And they catch a fish. They catch this enormous ray. They shoot it, actually, and they hang it up in the tree. And the people who live on the island resent this because you don't waste food. You don't waste fish. You don't disrespect the river. And then it does something I haven't quite figured out in terms of there seem to be like multiple overlapping timelines. And suffice it to say, things come to a bad end with these men who have been fishing on the river, and the local people are not happy with what's happened.
Yes, because one of the boys, his father had a bad experience
on
the river.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. And that history gets overlapped with what's happening in the present. And then there's also a fire in which there's two young women are killed. And that gets factored into it as well. And you feel like you've read a story that's taken place over years, almost over generations. And yet, it all just happens on a fishing trip in a river.
And the writing there, is it poetic?
It is very poetic.
Lyrical?
Yeah. And Selva Almada is a poet as well as a novelist. And it shows in a good way.
Okay.
It's really, really well written.
So Selva Almada there, and it's Not a River is the name of the book. So moving on to number four, we're going to Newfoundland.
We're going to Newfoundland with Michael Crummy's The Adversary. And this was a book, I was delighted to see this on the Dublin Literary Award shortlist, because Michael Crummy has been nominated for the Dublin Literary Award six times. He's been on the shortlist once before, back in 2011. And he's usually nominated by the library system in Labrador, Newfoundland. And they are staunch supporters of the Dublin Literary Award. Every single year, there's a book there from that library system. And I just think, you know, it's a sign of health in a place when you have a good library system.
Yes, and we have a good connection with there, haven't we? Wasn't it Alistair MacLeod and people from area?
I mean, well, Newfoundland. I mean, Newfoundland, you listen to the accent and you swear you're in Waterford or Wexford. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a pub in St. John's, Newfoundland called the Yellow Belly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that kind of place. Mm-hmm. Michael Crummie has been exploring the 19th century history of Newfoundland, and he has created a world that is entirely plausible. You just feel like you're immersed in this world. The way the people speak, the sense of the land, there are kind of interconnecting characters, and again, it just has that epic feel. So, I mean, if you like a novel that just will immerse you in a world you never would have imagined, this is it.
And these are people, it's kind of a family who owns big mercantile businesses and they fall out and there's a feud.
Yeah, well, big mercantile businesses in 19th century Newfoundland terms, which involves fishing cod by and large. And it's a sister and a brother. So it has a kind of parable-like quality where you have a sister and a brother feuding over this business that is kind of disintegrating around them.
And how that involves the whole community.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, moving on to book five, we have Percival Everett's James. So that's his retelling of the Huckleberry Finn story from the point of view of the slave, Jim, who he chooses to call James.
I mean, Percival Everett is a really remarkable talent. I mean, again, the second time he's been shortlisted, he was there for The Trees 2 years ago.
And The Trees was the story. Well, in some ways, it's like he uses humour in a remarkable
humor.
Way. I remember in The Trees because it's about history of lynching.
That's right.
But again, he uses humour here. And,
he's
talented.
He's a satirist, really. I mean, The Trees was about the Emmett Till lynching, but it's like a set in the present, and you have the people who were involved in that being kind of basically killed by zombies of the lynched come back. So it's this kind of weird comic horror, but there's a real rage in it, and this book has that as well. I mean, there are bits of this that are really, really funny, that when the character James, when he's around white people, he kind of talks slave talk, you know, I sure enough do that now. And then when he's on his own, he's reading Voltaire, he talks in perfectly grammatical English, and he gives the other slaves lessons on how to talk slave talk so that they don't, you know, they don't get caught out. But it's brilliant.
And wait, we have a clip here from James. Obviously, this is an epic adventure with the slave James on the run. And at one stage, he gets in with a group of minstrel singers.
Yes.
And the minstrel singers are run by a guy called Daniel de Court Emmett, who was a great writer of these minstrel songs. So we'll just play a clip with the reader, who is Dominic Hoffman, talking the words of Turkey in the Straw.
Turkey in the Straw. As I was going down the road, a tired team and a heavy load, I cracked my whip, and the leader sprung and says, "Day day to the wagon tongue." Chorus. Turkey in the Straw. Turkey in the hay, dance all nighty and work all day. Roll him up and twist him up a high tucker haul and hit him up a tune called Turkey in the Straw. Oh, I went out to milk and I didn't know how. I milked a goat instead of a cow. A monkey sitting on a pile of straw, a wink in his eye at his mother-in-law. Chorus, turkey in the hay, turkey in the straw. The old gray mare won't gee nor haw. Roll him up and twist him up a high tucker haw and hit him up a tune called Turkey in the Straw.
There's a clip there from James, and I think James then steals that book of songs from Emmett. The story then, it does relate in part to Huckleberry Finn. Huckleberry Finn is a character in it, but not everything mirrors what happens in Huckleberry Finn.
No, it's a kind of shadow of Huckleberry Finn. So you don't really have to have read Huckleberry Finn. It probably helps, but everybody kind of knows the story of, you know, going down the river. And a lot of the incidents are the same, but it's from a completely different different perspective. And I mean, the thing I say with Percival Everett that really I find striking with his work is that underneath the satire, underneath the humor, there is a real rage. There's a rage about racial injustice and racial inequality, and it comes through. I mean, you will not be unchanged by reading this book.
Now let's get on to our own man. That's Paul Lynch and Prophet Song. We've got a good track record of winning this award. I think it was Anna Burns the last.
Anna Burns won it. Yeah, Anna Burns won it. Mike McCormick won it. Kevin Barry won it. Colm Tobin won it, and the other Colm McCann won it. So. Yes, we've done well in the past, and you know I have to say you know being involved with the judging for a while, there's no favoritism shown to Irish writers. Irish writers win this and are shortlisted for this because Irish writing is going through a golden age right now.
Yes, because of course Paul is already a Booker winner. So tell us a little bit of the story, even though I think our listeners are probably familiar with it because we've talked to Paul on the show.
I mean, Paul once described it as an exercise in what he called radical empathy. And I think it's a good way of thinking about it. I mean, the story basically is of a very realistically imagined Dublin where there is a social collapse. There's basically a kind of internal coup. There's a civil war. And it's told really from the perspective of a character who is the, is a kind of average Dublin person. Her husband is a teacher. He's involved with the teaching union. She has children. And what makes the thing so scary is what she does is what you think, yeah, that's what I would probably do. I would try to get the kids to school. I would try to go down to the butcher's and buy sausages. I would look after my elderly parent who's on the other side of town. You don't do heroic things.
Let's hear a clip. Here's Kathy Belton reading from Prophet Song.
She hears it pass into thought, the sharp, insistent rapping. Each knock possessed so fully of the knocker she begins to frown. Then Bailey too is knocking on the glass door to the kitchen. He calls out to her, "Ma'am," pointing to the hallway without lifting his eyes from the screen. Ailish finds her body moving towards the hall with the baby in her arms. She opens the front door, and two men are standing before the porch glass, almost faceless in the dark.
There, Kathy Belton there reading from Paul Lynch's Booker winning and now nominated for the Dublin Literary Award, Prophet Song. Chris, it's a great chance, isn't it, for people to get these books now and read them and join in the fun of the judging panel, really.
Oh, it is. I mean, you know, the books are out there now. They're around Dublin City Libraries. They're in bookshops. There'll be a lot of events around on, you know, coming up in May when the winner's announced. So, yeah, it's a great chance to read them. And they're all really good reads. I mean, they're all enjoyable books to
Absolutely
read.
Absolutely sounds like it. Chris Morish, thank you so much. Chris is the chair of the jury for the Dublin Literary Award, which is sponsored by Dublin City Council. The winner will be announced on May the 22nd as part of this year's International Literary Festival Dublin. More details of the shortlist can be found on dublinliteraryaward.ie. Chris, thank you. Caoimhín Ó Rathéile and Thomas Bartlett, renowned for their work together as part of the Gloaming and individually with the likes of Laurie Anderson, Mary Chapin Carpenter, Taylor Swift and St. Vincent, released their self-titled album in 2019. The record was less about creating a finished product and more about capturing a moment, improvised, instinctive and responsive to their surroundings. Spanning locations from Mexico City to the UK's Real World Studios to New York, the music took shape in real time. Now they return to this body of work, to the National Concert Hall's The Cruelest Month. I'm delighted to be joined by Caoimhín in studio and Thomas on the line. Caoimhín and Thomas, you're very welcome. Caoimhín, you and Thomas played in The Gloaming for a good few years together on different sides of the stage, I think. When did you realise that you wanted to work together?
Well, I guess we had about 10 years of the gloaming, and we were on tour in Mexico, and we never really sat down to play together, just the two of us, but a chance presented itself. There was studio time that had been booked for the band, and it just so happened myself and Thomas ended up with the time and looked at each other and said, well, do you have any tunes? And we pressed record, and you know, we were surprised by what happened. I guess we didn't plan for it; it just kind of happened.
Yes, and it's a band that's open to improvisation. The gloaming, that is. So was it instinctive that you would then go down that path?
Well, it was. I mean, I felt it was just so beautiful what happened that day, and all the more beautiful for not being planned, I suppose. So we were keen that. To share it, I guess.
So, Thomas, the sunshine was blaring outside and you and Queeveen were stuck in a studio. How did it start? Who was the first person to play a tune?
I don't actually remember. I have to say, hi, Queeveen.
Hi,
I haven't
Thomas.
Heard your voice in many years, and it's so soothing and delightful to hear you. sorry. I suspect that it was Queeveen who first played a tune. But, you know, the thing is, just thinking about the gloaming and the way that band worked, I feel like there's that core of Martin and Dennis in the middle. And Queeveen and I were very often kind of making kind of ambient or more abstract things around that incredibly solid core. And it just hadn't occurred to me until we sat down to play that just those abstract things taken on their own could be actually a kind of beautiful thing. So it almost felt like we weren't doing anything all that different from what we'd been doing for 10 years.
Thomas, you got into the gloaming by, when you were a very young boy, pursuing Martin Hayes around Ireland. Isn't that right?
Yes, I was a creepy little stalker as a 10-year-old following Martin around the country. Yes, that's right.
Right, so yeah, you and your family came on a holiday and you persuaded your mum and dad to go and follow the concerts of Martin Hayes around the country.
Exactly, yes. I have very indulgent parents, and it's kind of amazing in retrospect that they were fine with that. But yes, that's exactly what happened.
Okay, let's listen to one of the tracks from the self-titled album of Queeveen and Thomas. This is Kestrel.
Thank you.
That's Kestrel from Caoimhín na Rathaeilis and Thomas Bartlett's album, which will be played live at the National Concert Hall as part of the Cruellest Month. The Kestrel, of course, you get that sense of a bird suspended in air. And it was accidental how this track came about, Caoimhín.
Well, yeah, I guess my memory of it, Thomas, correct me if I'm wrong, but we'd look at each other in the studio and say, what'll we do next? And we had no preparation done. We had no planning. So one of us might have a fragment of a tune and offer it up, and we'd maybe do one or two takes of it, and things would happen or not happen, and we'd move on to the next thing. And I just love how much space there is for your mind to wander and dream. And
is it afterwards, Thomas, then you think, God, that's like a bird? Or does Caoimhín play something and you think, oh, that's, I can play with that?
Well, like a bird, you know, all of the titling on this record comes from Caoimhín, because I'm somewhat allergic to titles. And so I think I just wanted them to be called, you know, 1, 2, 3. And Caoimhín held his ground. And but it's funny to hear that track just now. Last week I was in Bolivia and driving through the Andes at 5,000 meters, and had been putting on different music, and I never listened to music that I've made myself, but somehow I just had this feeling of like, ooh, this is what I want to listen to now, and put that on. And it's so amazing, because almost all the music that I end up making in life, I think, is really best for like late at night alone with a glass of whiskey. And I'm just delighted to find out that this record works really, really well with mountains.
Yes, I could imagine that from just listening to it. Caoimhín, where did you get into this free form? You know, when you were learning, let's say, tunes and learning them by notes, when did you get that sense of there's another way? There's another way to be a bit freer around music?
Well, I remember as a young 16-year-old, like Thomas, I stalked Tony McMahon, who, of course, worked in RTE for many years.
That's the way to go, obviously, yeah. A bit of stalking.
Yeah. I remember one of my first questions to him was, how do you make music that moves people? And it kind of sent me down a path of search and discovery for many years. But I suppose, yeah, it was through listening to all sorts of different music and following his advice and then ignoring his advice and following my own advice, playing with different people, thinking, reading, trying to think in different ways, I suppose. I suppose trying to analyse what it is that I loved about certain older traditional music, and it was often where your head ended up after listening to it, and to take that as the thing of value rather than the notes.
And you, Thomas, as somebody who is from Vermont, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Why was it? What was it about traditional music then that you saw freedom in rather than some kind of cage?
Well, you know, I was studying classical music kind of from a fairly young age as well. And then I had my dear friend Sam Amidon, who he and I started making music together when we were 5, I think. And he's also going to be part of this weekend. And Sam and I, the two things that we liked to do together was play basketball and play folk music. And it just felt learning things by ear and just being it felt like this extraordinary freedom to just to entertain ourselves with this music in a way that felt very different from the classical music that I was studying. And so it really was this kind of parallel track in my life that the two of them together, I think, were very fruitful.
Yes, of course, we've captured Sam Amidon as well. Michael Keegan-Dolan has been working with him recently here using his choreography with the wonderful ballads of Sam's.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You seem to have captured a number of Vermonters at this point. Yeah.
G.W. Sebald and the Rings of Saturn. That book, that wonderful book of touring, a walking tour he did of, I think it was England's East Coast. Is it an inspiration? It's an inspiration. You talk about it when you write about some of the tracks, even.
Yeah. One of my favourite books. It really is. And I think Thomas is a big fan of Sebald as well.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. And he's an improvisational kind of writer, too, if that's a way of describing him, Thomas, who can go from one subject to another through these little pebbles of wisdom.
Absolutely. And all of these circular structures where you don't quite realize until it happens that you're being brought back to a thought or an image that he had 50 pages earlier. And it gives this beautiful sense of both freedom and suspended animation, but also of everything kind of being connected in this way that I was not surprised, but delighted to find that he was a real favorite of both me and Quivine's, and it certainly feels like his aesthetic is one that I kind of aspire to in all things. Yeah.
Yes, and one of the tracks here is My Darling Asleep. So that's a traditional track. And what you like to do then is have it, but then deconstruct it. Would that be the right thing to say, Quivine?
Yeah, I guess allow it to fall apart rather than clinging onto the structure of it. Just allow it to fragment.
Okay, let's listen to that. This is My Darling Asleep. That's My Darling Asleep from Quivine O'Reilly and Thomas Bartlett's album of the same title as Thomas Bartlett and Quivine O'Reilly. Did you fight over which name would go first?
I think probably neither of us wanted to go first, Thomas.
Exactly, yeah.
No, it's your turn. Thomas, that kind of deconstruction or dissolution, I suppose, of the tune is something that you used to do in The Gloaming.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I think that was That was really one of the early exciting things with that band, was finding just Queeveen is such a master of you know, giving you little bits of like the remnants of a tune rather than the tune itself, which I find so powerful and so evocative.
Did you bring that to the Gloaming, or was it something that they were very open to anyway?
I'm not sure. It's so hard to remember details, I suppose. I probably enjoy pushing things towards the point where there's nothing left.
Yes, exactly.
In fact, I quite like starting from the point where there's very little to begin with. So I think that's what we heard there with My Darling Asleep. It's barely there. There's just the barest threads of the tune. And as that track goes on, they disappear.
Now, you've been very busy since the album was recorded. Thomas, you've been working with Taylor Swift, Rufus Wainwright and with Florence Welch on this Gatsby project, which is a musical based on The Great Gatsby.
Yes, that's right. And that really has, it's something that Florence and I wrote the first couple songs for many years ago. And I foolishly thought, oh, yeah, sure, I'll write a bunch of songs with Florence and that will just then it'll turn into a show. And it took over my life to an extent that is kind of, in retrospect, unbelievable to me. It turns out it takes a lot of time to write a musical. But yes, been a lot of the last few years.
Besides it's taking up a lot of time, was it enjoyable?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have to confess that I'm not a big fan of musicals in general, but I love both the book and I really love writing songs with Florence. And it's something that I had been doing some of for her own records, but it was a total joy to just buckle down. And I think over the course of the years, we wrote something like 60 or 70 songs that then have been whittled down to what is in the show at this point. So yes, it was a total delight.
Now, what are people going to hear at the National Concert Hall? Have you talked about, is it going to be what we're listening to on the album now? Or are you going to go off on one?
I think we're going to aim to play every note exactly as it is on the album.
Yes, the way we know you know.
Yes, and if we can fit the hour-long record into the 25-minute set that we have, it's going to be magic.
Okay, so we can expect variations.
I think so. I think that's
yes.
Yeah. Definitely. So will you meet and rehearse?
I guess so. Yeah, yes. We haven't got that far yet in any discussions. Yes. But
it'll be like being back in that studio maybe in Mexico. We'll just see what happens, Thomas.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. No, I think that's right. And I think that's kind of thrilling that, you know, I've been barely performing for the last few years. And I actually, before this interview was scheduled, I had thought, wouldn't it be fun if somehow Queeveen and I don't even speak or see each other until we get on stage for this moment? But
smiling. He's not scared. I think that's ideal for you, Queeveen, isn't it?
That sounds great. It does,
yes, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
Well, look, at my thanks to Queeveen O'Rahilla and Thomas Bartlett. You can see them at the National Concert Hall in Dublin as part of the Cruellest Month from the 12th to the 13th of April. It's a weekend of Irish debuts, collaborations and musical meetings featuring Mina Tyndall, Kate Staples, Bryce Dessner and many more. Maybe you would introduce Queeveen before we go, Good Things.
Yeah, All Good Things. I think this is a tune that I'd kind of written a bit of when I was down at a lovely festival in Baltimore in West Cork, and came away from it on the Monday wishing it could go on forever, and made up this little piece called All Good Things.
Well, Thomas and Queeveen, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Why are we still telling fairy tales? These stories, which are as old as time, posit good against evil and take the hero or heroine out of the domestic world and place them in a dark forest or a faraway galaxy or indeed Hogwarts. They are still very much at the heart of the narratives we tell and want to be told. The new release of the live-action Snow White has been roundly panned, including Arena's very own film reviewers last week. But what is it about fairy tales that still resonate, and what makes them different to the myths and legends we tell on this island? And I have an expert in front of me, Kelly Fitzgerald, assistant professor and head of folklore and ethnology at UCD. Kelly, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
So the Snow White seem to have got everything wrong. They went for very out there kind of political views. The Snow White was going to be transformative in the sense of Lenin and Trotsky make a socialist country. And then maybe they lost the subtlety of the story.
It's been really interesting, and it has really reinforced our love of these narratives, of these tales, and how we feel we own them. So if someone like Disney gets it wrong, it has just been such uproar about that. And it's really interesting how slight, if you mess with it and people don't accept it, it really has this kind of visceral response to it, which the latest film has had.
Let's play a clip from the original. This is the I'm Wishing, where she's looking into the well and wishing for her prince.
I'm wishing.
That's from the original Disney animated Snow White. And of course, the new version was live action. But the problem seemed to be manifold. First of all, I think the Evil Queen wasn't evil enough, and Snow White wasn't. Like, what is the original story about? What are we to think?
Exactly. And it's wonderful because why fairy tales work so well, or folk tales in the oral tradition, is that when black is black, it is very black. And when white is white, it's very white. And if you have any bit of color, it tends to be red. So we want these really striking images. It really makes it almost this kind of two-dimensional, abstract kind of imagery that people understand what they're getting, and they know who to root for, and they know who is the evil one that they want to see their demise. That is not difficult. And again, if you think of it, these are tales that engage our empathy within the first seconds of it being told or it coming across. And all of that is really important for people to kind of engage with it in the way they have for centuries, if not longer.
So Snow White leaves the palace and the nasty stepmom, and she goes into the forest, and then she meets the seven dwarfs. So what's happening there?
Again, it's quite interesting. So why these tales stick with us, right? You said it from the beginning there. In her home, her nice, wonderful home, things are not as they were. You know, she's disrupted and she's sent out into the world. And so we have Snow White's own journey of how she discovers who she is. And at the end of that, she has grown so much that she's sexually awakened to the point that she can take on a prince. We could look at it like that. We can also look at it again, that we see these tales telling us that the world is difficult. And even within our own homes, there may be difficulties there. And I think it's quite interesting, particularly in Ireland here, where people traditionally would not have spoken about their personal narratives quite openly. But why storytelling works so well here is because it's almost this coded language to talk about other things that are happening in the home or in the world or in one's life we can see happening here.
And the evil stepmother is so interesting because she's vain and beauty is so important to her. And the idea that Snow White might be a rival is what drives her ballistic and makes her want to poison her.
Yes, correct. And it's quite interesting. I mean, this is as old as time. The older woman losing her glamour, the younger woman kind of, I mean, how many times do we see this being played out? You know, men, we can get a whole story here about men and how they engage with women and how this puts us kind of against each other, vying for those positions. Now, we don't know if, again, if Snow White's father was anyway creating any of this tension, but definitely the wicked stepmother. And of course, that resonates here in Ireland because it is so against cultural norms to want your beauty to stay and remain or anything like that. Traditionally would be seen so evil and not something one should engage with.
Now, what then is the role of, you said that there's a kind of sexual awakening when she's waiting for her prince to come. But what usually is the role of the Prince Charming in these fairy tales?
Exactly. And again, the prince is very two-dimensional. We don't see any real growth or development. You know, he is good. We're on his side. And traditionally, it is that sense kind of bringing, whether it's Cinderella or Snow White, you know, you get your prince at the end of this. There can be a lot of escapism there, that sense of fantasy. You can imagine these tales in a very rural setting. This is absolute fantasy. So again, this sense that someone is going to come along and kind of make all your wishes come true and this life that's so much easier. So there's a lot that we can see. Various people can get a lot from these tales.
And now sometimes they do get it right in the modern reimagining of fairy tales. We'll just play a clip from Tangled.
I am the lost princess, aren't I? Did I mumble, Mother? Or should I even call you that?
Oh, Rapunzel, do you even hear yourself? Why would you ask such a ridiculous question?
It was you! It was all you!
Everything I did was to protect you.
Rapunzel! I've spent my entire life hiding from people who would use me for my power. Rapunzel! When I should have been hiding from you!
So Rapunzel is in the tower. She's been captured by this witch who she believes is her mother. What's going on there?
I know, it's so fabulous. It's such, again, one of these fabulous Grimm tales that has just stayed with us. And when Tangled came out, it was so fabulous because it worked. They stayed so true to the tales that people have really felt connected to, but yet they were able to give an agency to Rapunzel that perhaps wasn't there before. And they did it so well. And it was such a change. And we would call that like a fractured fairy tale or bringing these into a much more contemporary setting of what we're seeing. And they just got it so right there.
And hair is the centre of this. We're going back to that idea of femininity, beauty, and then isn't the hair cut off and all how the old hag treats the hair.
Exactly. And it's quite interesting if you think of it. If we think of the Banshee here in Ireland, her most prized possession is her comb. As haggard and as ugly as she is, she still treasures what her hair is. So hair is a really important kind of cultural aspect. And we see how it's been used in the 20th century when the shearing of women's heads and the cutting of that. So all of that sense of that beauty and sexuality coming through it. And I do think in Tangled, it really kind of gave a different perspective for a young woman and how she's engaging with this, with the hair.
So many psychoanalysts and writers like people like Marina Warner have had Grey, even Neil Jordan in The Company of Wolves, based on Angela Carter, have had great, I wouldn't say fun, but have been, you know, absorbed by this as a topic and what it means in terms of, I suppose, the sexual being.
Absolutely. I mean, and to go back, I mean, the Grimm Brothers has been as popular as the Bible, has been translated, has, you know, it's one of these iconic texts, and the tales that are in it, people know so well. And when you mention Angela Carter or people looking at it from that Jungian point of view, it is kind of really recognizing the kind of into the deep psyche of who we are as human beings and how we engage with each other and our kind of core family base, having this kind of archetypical existence of how we are to be human.
And then you say as well that there are a number, let's say we have versions of story, I think Cinderella, you have a version that's based in Donegal.
Oh, there's a fabulous version of Cinderella here in Ireland. And again, this international sense of these tales have spread the world over, but yet then they find their context or they find it in the local. So we have a fabulous tale in Donegal where it's not the ball that she has to come home by midnight, but it's mass. And she has to leave by the last gospel. And she has to get home to make Sunday lunch for her stepmother and father. And if it's not finished, she'll know she'll be in trouble. So it's these wonderful, it's so fabulous. And yet we find it absolutely working within the Donegal context.
Let's go to a father-son relationship, and we'll go to Star Wars. Here's Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker.
There is no escape. Don't make me destroy you. Luke, you do not yet realize your importance. You have only begun to discover your power. Join me, and I will complete your training. With our combined strength, we can end this destructive conflict and bring order to the galaxy.
I'll never join you!
If you only knew the power of the dark side, Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him.
No, I am your father.
Some shock there for Luke Skywalker, but it's not unlike Tangled, is it?
No, absolutely. Isn't it quite interesting? This kind of father-son relationship. And we have Luke Skywalker, as pure as can be. Again, quite interesting. You find out that Princess Leia is his sister. All it gets very complicated in that regard. But yet, filmgoers and the success of that whole series, there's a lot that goes into it. But you can't dismiss that kind of core, simplistic way of storytelling and the way in which we engage with what is good and what is evil. And that belief that good will win out over evil. These are stories we still definitely need in our times today.
Well, Kelly Fitzgerald, that was fascinating. Thank you so much for talking to us this evening. That's it for tonight's show. Liam Murphy and Simon O'Gallagher were the researchers. James Feeney was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Shan O'Gorman. John Creedon is next after the news.